Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. It's an underdog story for the ages. In one corner, the champion of the world. In the other, a bum from the streets of Philly. This week, we talk Rocky on Zach on Film.
Truly, a film for the ages.
Yes.
I don't know if Zach gets that reference.
No.
Man, inspired sure sound words funny from a man who knows how to ski.
Howard Cosell, man. He was the voice of sports in the 1970s and 80s.
Sports.
Yes, he was the man.
So, yeah, this is a, like you said, Zach, it's a story of a bum who makes it good. And it is some people would say the ultimate schmaltzy movie of all time, because it follows, and some could argue that it created a lot of the tropes of this underdog who fights and wins at the end, who works hard and perseverance and makes something of himself.
Sure.
The interesting thing is this is kind of based on, the Muhammad Ali, Chuck Wepner fight that Stallone saw in 1975. And check this out. As far as writing goes, immediately after seeing that fight, Stallone locks himself in his bedroom for 3 days straight and pounds this script out in about, roughly 20, three and a half days, 20 hours each day working on this, and then comes out and emerges with this masterpiece of Rocky.
Yeah, what I think is interesting about Rocky is, I think there's a lot of good stuff inside the movie, but kind of the stories around the film make this really a better experience overall for me. I mean, like the story of Stallone.
Really enhance the experience.
Yeah, Stallone is so poor, he has to sell his dog. He can't buy dog food while he's trying to be an actor out in Hollywood. Meets with some executives, kind of gives them a couple stories. They're like, nah. He's like, well, I got this other idea for a story. They're okay, bring it back. Like 3.5 days later, he brings it back. They want it, but they don't want him to act in it necessarily. They want some other guy.
Robert Redford.
As one guy I heard, they have originally, the studio gives a $5 million budget. No, cut it down to under $1 million. And then that's how Sylvester Stallone gets cast, because, well, he wrote it. We don't have much money to spend on this movie, so he gets cast. And they even thought he was the wrong guy in a movie he did previously. They were looking at someone completely different that wasn't Stallone. Like, oh, that guy was pretty good. Yeah, we'll hire Stallone.
Yeah. Well, and even, I mean, they had for Adrian. You know, they had Susan Sarandon at one point in there. Mm. They thought that she looked too pretty for the role. But yeah, I mean, basically it was, if we're going to hire Stallone to play this character, then we're lowering the budget. We're going to cripple this at the knees. And if you look at it, the movie takes place in just a couple of locations. It takes place in the ring at the end, takes place at the boxing, Rocky's apartment.
Streets of Philadelphia.
Streets of Philadelphia, which we can talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but
meatpacking
plant and the apartment, the house that Adrian lives in. And it's really one room and a half of whole thing. We never really see the kitchen. No. Well, we do kind of at one point where he throws the Thanksgiving turkey out the door. And a little bit of Adrian's bedroom, but that could be anywhere.
Oh yeah, it could have been anywhere.
But mainly that living room. And this is one of the cool things about this being such an inexpensive movie, $1 million.
Yeah.
Million and a half by the time it was done. It's, I think they spent like $400,000 on publicity $4 million on publicity
adjusted,
or something like that.
Adjusted, it was a bit over $4 million.
That's still incredible. That'd be a $4 million movie.
Yeah, for this time.
That would be incredible because, I mean, you look at some of the cheap movies that come out today. Kevin Smith can do it, but you look at even 300. That's a $30 million movie right there.
Which is considered like one of the cheapest, biggest successful movies. Films in like the last decade.
Yes, exactly.
$30 million. And that was like no sets. I mean, that was all blue
all green screen. Yeah, all post-production.
Everything.
But this one is all basically sound effects and makeup work. I mean, you don't have special, I mean, you have special effects, but even that is down to the cheap. I mean, when you see... Here's the cool thing about sound effects in this movie. If you watch that final scene between Apollo Creed and Rocky Balboa, you watch it first with the sound turned up, and then watch that scene again with the sound turned down, And those guys, you can tell they're missing each other by a mile.
If you even know the look for it, you can have the sound on, like, oh, that wasn't even close. Especially when they do that, like, God's point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a couple of them, oh, Apollo missed him by about a foot and a half.
I mean, this movie was done at such a low budget that Stallone had to call his family in to be in this movie. his brother Frank, Frank Stallone, was one of the street singers.
Right.
His father was the bell ringer and composed some of the music in this piece. Now, Bill Conti did the famous Gonna Fly Now Rocky theme. That Bill Conti also, if I'm not mistaken, is the person who did the music on The Karate Kid. So if you listen to The Karate Kid opening and you listen to Gonna Fly Now, you hear a lot of tonal similarities between between the two.
Yep.
His mother...
Which is good because it's the same movie.
Pretty much. His then wife played, I think, the court reporter or a reporter in one of the scenes. So he brought a lot of his family in because this was such a low budget. The famous scene where it's like, hey, can I get 10 minutes on the ice for my girlfriend? Mm-hmm. That had to be rewritten because they couldn't afford to shoot when the rink was open and pay all the extras that they needed to fill that place. So they're let's just rewrite it when it's closed. Like,
That's just such a great example of like things working out for the better.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because if that was done in a crowded rink, that would just
wouldn't have been as good.
I don't think you would have had that personal connection of Rocky really
it's like
desperately really, trying to get the girl.
It's like 10 times more romantic.
So yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then the guy yelling desperate. At how much time they have.
Yeah,
left.
Yeah.
Just 7 minutes.
Yeah.
which leads me to something that I didn't realize until this time watching Rocky. Because I, again, like a lot of movies from the 70s, I'd only seen it in a piecemeal fashion. Right, but like Rocky is a romantic comedy.
Yes. Well,
in a way.
I mean, would say it's definitely a romance.
Yeah. Like
a romantic movie.
I think that Rocky is a romantic comedy bookended by a sports movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I would say it's more of a romance movie than a comedy. I think it's the inability for Rocky, the character, to connect with people that makes his actions very funny because he's always just been this person who's a bruiser and no one wants to talk to him because he breaks legs
and
for
he's
a living.
Big, scary guy.
And he's a big, scary guy.
Sounds dumb.
5 feet eight.
But... sticking on the romantic thing, that scene after the rink when he's bringing Adrian back to his home felt like the most awkward, super like sexually pushy, super freaky scene
I'm
ever
gonna
world.
Kiss you, but you don't have to kiss me back.
Yeah, that scene like put me off for it 40 minutes. It's like, this is really creepy.
In light of things that are going on today, it does seem very rapey.
Well, in light of things that were going on back then, but now we know.
Right.
Oh, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That scene,
you know,
and again, because I, just like The Godfather, Rocky is not a movie I can remember just sitting down and blowing through on AMC with all the commercial breaks. I've watched pieces of it. I mean, I've seen most of the movies, but again, haphazardly all over the place. And I don't remember ever seeing that scene before. And so when we got that point, like, whoa, what? And it kind of started that whole date scene with Pauly coming to get Adrian with Rocky, how they essentially just force her to go on this date she doesn't really want to get to. And I kind of look at different angles as like, oh, they're trying to force her to get out of this bubble. But that's like still really awkward because you shouldn't have to force someone to do something.
And it's kind of I think there's two things there. One, it kind of used to be a lot more acceptable that if there was like any man in your life as a woman, they would just be able to tell you what to do. And the other one is a matter of, I think it's a matter of direction. I think that Adrian is supposed to have somewhat obvious feelings for Rocky, and there are times when it comes out, but during those scenes it just becomes super. Like, she's too good at playing standoffish, and I think some of the tension is supposed to come from the fact that she's nervous around him.
Well, and she
and
even
not from the fact, or you know, from the fact that she's nervous around him because she likes him, not because she's nervous about this big scary guy.
Well, and I think there's also this thing where she comes out and says it. She goes, "My mom said I didn't have much of a body, so I have to use my brain." So from an early age, she's been very put down upon and told right. that she's a nobody.
Yep. Right.
Pauly does not do anything to help that situation where he constantly berates her, probably mm-hmm. beats her, you know, prior to us meeting her in this piece.
Yeah.
Because he's such a violent drunk. And so she's shy, but I think she's comes off very awkward because I think she's trying to come to grips with somebody actually likes me for me.
Right, right.
Not because right. somebody, you know, yeah. it's not Pauly forcing Rocky on me. He likes me for yeah, me. Right. And I think she's trying to come to grips with
and
that.
And that's something that I think comes to light later when it becomes throughout very clear that yeah. she is super into mm-hmm. Rocky. Like, oh, yeah. once I mean, she comes out of that, once it's
they
fine.
Once they spend their romantic time together, what's right. the next thing you see her? She's not wearing mousy clothes anymore. Right. She's not yeah. wearing her glasses anymore.
She's all over him. Yep. Like, yes. she is, like, yep. constantly, like, perched on him, hugging him, trying to get into his pants when he's like, no, yeah. babe, I need to train. Like, it's
no fooling around when I'm training.
Afterwards, in retrospect, it becomes clear that right. that's what was happening. But at the moment that yes. scene is unfolding,
oh, yeah, I think
it's
horrible.
Super
yeah.
creepy.
Yeah, yeah. Really, in my mind, you cut that scene out, and it plays out exactly how they want it to. Mm-hmm. But with that, it's yeah. like, oh, this is what you have to do to get the girl you want.
Yeah, yeah.
It's weird.
I think it's kind of there in the same vein as the scene where we see Rocky going to break the guy's thumbs. Because that sequence where Rocky first catches the guy and he's trying to drive away on his forklift and he chases him down and slams him against the wall. And then he's like, okay, I won't break your thumbs this time. Right. That whole scene is kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
We're supposed to look at him and everybody sees him as this big, overbearing brute. But he's trying... Mm. not to be that. He's not really what he seems to be, so mm-hmm. it is still a creepy scene.
But going back
and taken in that context.
And through the time period in which it is, how many times do we see the shot of the guy's like, oh man, it's getting hot in here. And he takes it off and he's this big beefcake and he's flexing his muscles. I mean, we see Bluto do that with olive oil
yeah.
in the old cartoons where he's flexing his muscles and she's like, oh, all Twitter-pated. And we see kind of that happening with Adrian, yeah. when he takes off his sweater and shirt and he's there and he's really ripped.
Sure.
Oh, geez,
and she's yeah. just like, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do in this situation. This man has taken off half of his, mm-hmm, half mm-hmm. of his clothes. Yeah. But so, yeah. So there are moments that are very comedic, but I think I've always thought of this as a romantic movie, not a sports movie, which is what it's billed as
right,
a sports
right,
movie.
Right. I mean, it kind of offhandedly defines the sports movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been,
oh, sure.
You know, Matthew pointed out Karate Kid is the same movie. You know, The Mighty Ducks is the same movie.
Well, I mean, you look at The Natural as kind
with
of the
one
same
major
thing.
Exception.
Sure.
One major exception in this. Rocky did not win that fight.
No, he didn't. But
Rocky
and that's,
lost the fight
and
at the end. But he got there with his tenacity. Mm-hmm. But it's the thing, you know, in The Mighty sure. Ducks, they win their little
right,
copy thing.
Sure. Right.
And Ralph, you know, kicks the guy in the face and does the illegal face kick and wins the trophy. All of these movies are taking that and playing it straight. This takes that final thing as, no, he didn't win his fight. He won what was more important. He won his respect and he won Adrian.
Yeah,
so
that's what the whole
thing
is.
This film is a lot more complicated than some of the stuff that's made trying to ape its themes and ape its tropes, for lack
but
of
a better word. But it doesn't come off at the end like, oh, the big team or the underdog didn't win. It seems, oh, there's so much fanfare happening. Even the music
exactly.
building is like, this dude won. There is no question yeah. he won.
When you talk about the direction of this movie, like the mm-hmm. directing of this mm-hmm. movie, and when you talk about sound design and all that stuff, they make it so that if you blink your ears, I guess, is what I'm saying. If you stop paying attention, if you get caught up in anything for a second, you miss that Rocky actually lost
yeah,
the
yeah,
fight.
Yeah, yeah.
It just, it's a great moment because it's kind of relevant. It's important. You know, you kind of want to know who won, but, and because of the nature of boxing,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
you kind of have to wait to figure out who won. But the movie just in such a perfectly organic way tells you, shows you mm-hmm. that it doesn't matter.
Yeah, right. yeah, oh yeah. There's two real important parts about that. At the very first fight he has at the beginning of the movie, as he's walking off and he's bumming a cigarette, one of the people in the crowd says, "You're a bum. You're a bum, mm-hmm. bum, yeah. bum," and just hammers it into his head that he's a bum, he's a nobody, nothing. at the end of the movie, you hear the crowd yelling Rocky, 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 or part of the crowd yelling Rocky, Rocky, Rocky. And then there is a very definite, as you're saying, tonal, aural experience that goes on where even though they're calling out this split decision on two votes for Apollo Creed and one for Rocky, it's way muted down to where you really have to pay attention, because at this point he knows that he's won. He's, as you said, he's won the respect and he's won the girl, which is what this whole movie is about. Him no longer being a bum and actually earning respect.
Well, the idea of what is winning with this fight changes when he's restless and goes to the ring and sees they painted his trunks wrong. And the guy's like, what does it matter? Yeah. He's like, oh, it doesn't matter. If no one really cares. No one expects me to win. And he goes back home and says, all I want to do is go the distance.
Yep.
That's all he wants to do. Yeah. He doesn't really care if he wins. He doesn't think he should win.
Right.
He just wants to prove that.
Right. He wants to fly now. He wants to try now.
Yeah. And he wants to show that it matters. Like that he was there and he made a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the story tells that
scene is
splendidly.
Yeah. That scene is another one where they had to scramble because apparently the painting was painted wrong. And they wrote that scene to explain why the painting of Rocky had the trunks wrong.
Which is weird, because I don't think
there's a couple of those in there.
Besides that, like, one
point. No, and that's the thing. They showed it, and they showed him looking at it, and it was a big deal there, where it's like, this is the moment where he realizes that Apollo is not taking him seriously.
Sylvester Stallone.
Apollo is taking him as a joke.
Sylvester Stallone, even back in the 70s, knowing that someday there would be film nerds. I mean, they're probably they were at the time already, but like someday there's going to be an internet, and I don't want this to end up in a blooper page or in a continuity.
The same
page.
Thing with his robe. The thing where he's like, is it too big for me? What is it? Is it too baggy? That's another thing. They made the robe. They didn't have a chance to alter it.
Nice.
So they put in the dialogue saying, is this robe too big? Which really, you know, it underlines this guy's an underdog.
Yeah.
They couldn't even get his robe right.
Also,
That's how little they care about this.
But he also doesn't care. The character Rocky
doesn't really care
about that stuff. It's like, hey, what's this meatpacking sign on the back? He said, I told Paulie he could sell it for whatever he want, you know. And he just doesn't, at this point, at that point in the film, when the promoter says it doesn't really matter and Rocky goes home and is all upset and he says, all I want to do is go the distance. From that point, he doesn't give a crap about anything else. He doesn't care how much Paulie made off the selling of the piece. He doesn't care if the robe is baggy. He doesn't care if he doesn't care about anything. He doesn't care about the decision. He just wants to know that he went toe to toe with the champ and did it. And he, you know, he made some money. He is able to take Adrian out of this conditions that they're in Philadelphia and give them something better. Because $150,000 in 1975 dollars is a lot.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's like $11 zillion today.
He buys a suite.
Allowing
for
inflation.
He bought all that money.
Yeah,
he bought the moon. He bought the moon.
The other thing that's really interesting is the minute that Rocky's on television and they announce the money, how much money he's going to get. Man, all of his friends just come out of the woodwork.
Sure.
No,
You can see Paulie. You can see Paulie just licking his lips and wiping his sweaty, greasy wife beater, and is just like, "Hey, you need somebody to manage you." And then Mickey comes in and does his thing.
There's a lot of stuff in this movie where it's like, again, this is like the real prototype for that sports movie, right? And like all of those movies that are prototypes, it's way better than everything that came out after it because they weren't trying to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the character of Paulie in the Mighty Ducks would have turned out to be like super unscrupulous and then learns his lesson or has a change of heart. And then he's like, oh, I'm sorry that I ever doubted you, Rocky. But no, he's just kind of friends and like they fight and then they're fine. And then they're like fight again and they're like mad at each other. And then they're like, okay. Yeah. You can punch them.
Then they're fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then they're fine. Mm-hmm. Like the other thing that is just like amazing, so amazing to me as I was watching it, I was watching this movie in disbelief because, again, I didn't catch these things the first time. His mob guy, the guy that he's breaking legs for, shows up to support him. Like he asked him, he's like, hey, it would mean a lot to me if you came to see it. He's like, yeah, I'll go see it.
Because
and
he's probably
he got
money on it.
Totally.
And I kept waiting I'm giving you this $500 plus interest.
At no point does anybody like ask Rocky to take a fall and he decides not to. At no point does anyone like, at no point does he say, no, I'm not going to be a leg breaker anymore. He's like, no, I got to like, he's actually kind of friends with this mob guy.
Yeah.
Or he's trying to be like, he kind of weirdly looks up to him and he wants him there.
But isn't there also that bit of local boy makes good where, you know, suddenly he's on television. Mm-hmm. People know that he's one of the good Philly boys. He's one of us and he's going to fight. So now people are cheering him on in the streets, throwing him an apple. You've got the totally mobster random, guy giving him $500 and saying, hey, this is for your training. You've got, you know, the news reporter coming down to show how he's punching the meat, which is a great iconic scene.
Yeah.
And people are just interested in this local story about somebody who's going to take on the world champion. Mm-hmm.
Just another great scene, which I totally did not remember being there, is like the guy who's watching TV and he's like, hey, Apollo, you should come look at this. And he's like,
yeah.
It's like all of a sudden it's like, wow. Because that's, again, the movie is really subtle. Like at no point, I don't know that at any point anybody says, you know, Rocky's actually pretty good. He could go the distance.
Yeah. No one ever says it.
The manager
Mickey
of
does.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, not Mickey, but the manager of Apollo Creed recognizes it too. That's why he points it out.
Well, and he does, but that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is no one verbalizes it, but the movie shows you the moment that Apollo's cap shows concern.
Mm-hmm.
Is you're like, oh wait, Rocky's in this,
and that's a great scene because they show him on the news and he's just punching that meat, and they just show him with his hands, and you're just covered in blood.
Yeah,
and it's so cool.
It's pretty intense. I mean, when he does that, I mean, again, I don't know how many. I got to see this movie when it came out. I don't know how many people want to mimic that whole punching the meat scene after that movie. Yeah, you don't want to do that.
You'll mess yourself up. Seriously. Cows are
fingers are permanently misshapen from it.
Again, that little trick that he does with his pinky, that is literally him having a dislocated pinky.
And the thing that's interesting to me about specifically Mickey is I remember Rocky 2 and Rocky 3 better than this movie. And in that, Mickey is kind of a sweet old man with a heart of gold. Sure, he's kind of, you know, he's kind of a mouthy old kind of angry man. Yeah. But in this, he's kind of a jerk.
Everyone is a horrible person.
Until money comes involved and people
Adrian is fine.
Yes.
Everyone else is horrible. Even her boss is in the movie for like 10 seconds. Yeah. She's horrible.
She's like, go clean out the crappy cat pens, Adrian.
Yeah.
They made a horrible mess.
Even that moment where Mickey is like, you know why I treat you the way I treat you? Because you could have been something. That doesn't come across as him turning around and saying, you know, Rocky, you could still be something. That's Mickey basically, you know, pronouncing it over. You could have been something, but you're a bum and that's all you are.
That
to me is such a weird scene, but it's so great as, you know, that little moment of manipulation.
Yeah,
almost.
Almost. And again, it's like it's so weirdly realistic because when you have a fight with someone a lot of the time, you know, especially with your friends or especially when dudes have fights with other dudes, there's very rarely a moment when you say, hey, you know, I'm sorry about what I said. What I really meant was this or blah, blah, blah. There's just kind of like you just kind of get back into it. Yeah. And then that's that.
Hey,
like
Rocky, I'm sorry.
Like at no point does Rocky say, okay, you can actually train me.
Right.
He just shows up at the gym and the guy starts training
him.
Well,
you have that shot where you don't know what's being said when he chases him down the street and they shake hands and is like, hey, is everything okay?
You can
imagine what's being said.
Right.
Yeah, but it's never, like, nothing's ever explicitly said in this movie.
There's just so much of it is just like, meh.
In the 70s, could you do that? Could you have two men having a moment together? Because in this movie, we don't see it, but in... I forget which one it is, 2 or 3, where Apollo Creed has to come. Yeah, with Mr. T, the Mr. T fight. Mm-hmm. So it's in 3, where Apollo Creed has to come to Rocky and they have to, Apollo has to bring Rocky back and they have to work together and do stuff. That's a bro moment.
Yeah, man.
Right.
And that's like 80.
Because Clubber Lang kills Mickey.
Yeah.
I think you can. I mean, we saw stuff like that in The Great Escape, for example.
True.
Where he's like, I'm super scared of being inside this thing. And like, they kind of talk him down and they're like total bros about it, you know? Or like, you have the guys talking across the cells. It's not necessarily exactly like, you know what? You matter to me, dude.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have seen stuff like that. And I think it's rare, but I think it has actually gotten more rare.
Yes.
Like just kind of guys talking to each other has become more rare as partially because of guys like of characters like Rocky, this archetype, this stereotype of what a manly man should be gets kind of mutated into what we see today.
Yeah. Right. And this is still part of that. You know, we've referenced it before. We referenced it during Bonnie and Clyde. We referenced it during American Graffiti. This is still that weird American New Wave thing, I think, is what Steven had called it previously, where you made these movies because you had a specific story to tell. You didn't necessarily have, you know, story beats and tropes that you had to hit because the focus group said it. You could have a moment like at the end of Apocalypse Now where everything just kind of goes right out the window and you hate everybody on screen.
And again,
this movie undermines a lot of the cliches that we attribute to it.
Except
it undermines that Obi-Wan mentor guy. It undermines the ending. It undermines a lot of this stuff.
Question the first, Zach.
Yeah.
Compare this to On the Waterfront.
It's been a long time since we watched On the Waterfront. You have a lot of similar ideas of a main character who is kind of a bum, who kind
is a mob enforcer.
Yeah, kind of fell out with fighting.
Wants to date the girl but doesn't know how to get with her.
Uh-huh.
Who ultimately has to come to a decision in a big fight on what he's going to do.
Yeah. They have a big fight at the end. And they have interesting camera techniques.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I ask question the second? Because I think I know question the second.
Sure, go ahead. No, my question the second is something totally different.
Okay. I thought Steven's question the second, Zach, was going to be contrast this to Raging Bull.
Yeah, you could do that too. This is now our third boxing movie. Yeah,
this one's in color.
Yeah. Well, there's that part of Raging Bull in color.
And let's put a pin on that for later. There's something that I've been meaning to talk about these movies in general, but that's kind of a discussion for later.
No,
but
go ahead, jump in now, because we're going to go take a sponsor reading.
So
here
these
in just a second,
so these movies are
these three movies in particular.
No, all of these movies.
Okay.
Where does the list come from?
A book,
right?
Yeah.
So
and of course National Registry,
right?
Yeah,
right.
So somebody like people get together and vote on what movies should go into the National Registry, right? Who's voting for these movies?
I don't
movies?
Know who votes for these.
I'm going to guess it's old white guys.
It might be.
Oh, because you see so many Scorsese movies.
Yeah.
True.
And that's the thing is, you know, and we are kind of going off this list and kind of going off the National Registry, and you do see a surprising number of boxing movies.
Mm-hmm.
A surprising number of against all odds white dude changes everything, which, to be fair, there's a trillion movies that are that way.
Mm-hmm.
But a little behind the scenes thing, after we did The Thing, I was talking to Steven and I was like, so in The Thing, there are literally no women.
Right.
There are literally zero women.
Right.
Not even in the background. It's just a bunch of guys. So I was like, do we have a movie that on the list that has a central female kind of thing? And the best we could do on the list was Bonnie and Clyde.
Of the remaining ones.
Bonnie and Clyde.
Boogie Nights, at the time I made this list, I don't think Boogie Nights had come out yet. Boogie Nights has some strong female characters in it.
Well, Thelma and Louise has some strong female characters in it. There's those movies out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this list of movies, again, great for themes, great for cinematography, but by no means definitive that language.
No, this
of
is actually the list that I've come up with is basically going down and picking out iconic movies that people should be very, very familiar with.
Right.
Out of a list of 500 movies.
Sure.
So there's a list of 500 movies that this book, and I think it was a film editing book, was like, here's 500 movies you should go and watch if you haven't. I was like, there's no way I can ever suggest to my students to read 500, but I can narrow this list down to, I think this list is only like 75. And so I just went, okay, let's go through and let's pick some iconic movies that people should know just from a single frame.
Sure.
Should be able to sum up that entire movie with just a single frame.
And especially
it's not meant to be, well, Steven's a white guy, and he picked only white guy movies.
Well, no, but that's also kind of true. I mean, you know,
That's unintended racism.
Sure.
Though.
I mean, it's not even racism. It's just kind of that inertia, you know.
Right.
Because you know you are
an
a white guy.
Bias.
Yeah. It's not meant to be that, and that's why I'm clearing that up. Is that we are not saying that these movies that we've done on Zach on Film are the be all and end all.
No, but they are right. Definitive movies right. that have made some kind of an impact in film theory,
right?
Film history. Film discourse mm-hmm. and movie making,
right?
That if Zach hasn't seen, he's putting himself at a disservice.
Sure.
And I think it's kind of important to look at. I don't know if we've really watched any movies that were made outside of America. If we've had, it's been.
Yeah, we watched Seven Samurai.
No, we didn't.
Oh, we haven't watched that in this?
No, we watched The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, we did Magnificent
Seven. I thought we watched there's Seven a lot Samurai
of,
at one point.
And so what I'm getting at is like the right. American cinema is a huge force. Mm-hmm. I mean, like we track box office numbers worldwide, mm-hmm. and a lot of big movies are made in America. But we've referenced like French New Wave films mm-hmm. and a lot right. of other films that right. are coming out from all across the world. And so, but these are recognizable anywhere. A lot right. of French New Wave films, a lot of other stuff that are made by great people across the world. Aren't as recognizable by the general public in large. And so, like, and we've referenced this a couple times, is these are really good jumping off points to go watch other films. Like, we right, listed, like, right. five other films we should go watch
yeah,
last
for the
time.
Monster movies, yeah.
And so, yeah. So these are really important films that some steal from creators of different works of across the seas that are just, sure, they see sure. films in art houses and they apply mm-hmm. stuff to their films.
So sorry for that derail.
No, that's fine. I mean, that's good because that was a conversation that we had. Again, that was a conversation Rodrigo and I had several yeah. weeks ago. And it's not that there's any kind of a maliciousness in this list. That's not that's not the point. And I hope that people are not thinking, well, Steven's just a... No, that's not the point. This is me trying to narrow down a list of 500 movies to 75 iconic movies mm-hmm. that people should have seen.
Yeah. And now that I'm kind of more and I look at more film globally recently, it's the kind of difference of looking at the Oscars and looking at the Cannes Film Festival that just wrapped up. Mm-hmm. Like, if you see films that come out of there, or even the American films that play over there are generally cult classics over here, like Pulp Fiction won the Palme d'Or over there. Mm-hmm. And very few American films ever win like the second highest honor you can get in a movie in a year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's movies coming in from all over the world over there. And so, I mean, it's just we are American people that look at a lot of American films because that's all that really plays in America is American films. And so,
which, you know, and then that part of it's somewhat sad. And I don't know what the release of Rocky was. It was a wide release movie eventually. Mm-hmm. But even Star Wars, when it first came out, the movie theaters were like, we're going to play this on East Coast, West Coast only. And there's no way. I mean, I think it was open in 20 theaters the first weekend, 14 theaters in the first weekend. And that's all that they were intending on doing. And so a lot of times when we look at movies like these, the reason why they become phenomena is because they have had some kind of an impact in our social awareness of ourselves. Mm-hmm. They've become part of our tradition. And whether it's Citizen Kane and saying, well, this is the first time that we've ever seen ceilings in a movie, and why was Orson Welles so bent on making Kane larger than life in his framing, well, that has a big impact on how movies like High Noon come out.
Sure.
And when you watch The Simpsons, and this is the thing that really torqued me off and got me to do this list years and years ago, and you know, I hand it out every year, is that people would watch The Simpsons. And it was the episode of Homer in Space,
mm-hmm.
where it was nothing but 30 minutes of reference after reference after reference of every space movie.
Yep.
And I was going into my class talking about how awesome this was and how this is the first time that we see 3D animation tuned up to look like 2D animation. And they had no idea what 2001 A Space Odyssey
right,
was. They don't understand that potato chip docking sequence is the docking sequence from 2001.
Right.
They don't get the Planet of the Apes reference. They don't get any of the stuff. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. You're sitting there laughing at Homer's hysterical antics, and yet you don't know where it comes from.
You're laughing at half the thing.
Yeah. And it happened again about 10 years later. maybe not even 10 years. Well, yeah, definitely 10 years later from the point where I first started introducing this list to my class. So this is about a 20-year-old list. I'm sitting, I'm walking through the student lounge newsroom, and they're watching a bit from Family Guy, one of the cutaways where they cut to Orson Welles just screaming peas, and some people laugh at that, and they kept playing it again and again and again and again, and I just sat there for a minute, and I was just like, "You guys know who that is?" And they're like, "No." Mm-hmm. I was like, "Do you know what that's referencing?" "No." I was like, "You guys are missing out on your cultural history of who this is." Orson Welles, number one. Mm-hmm. Point in his life where he was at his lowest and selling himself out for commercials.
Which is what the joke is.
And he's drunk off his ass in the actual commercial, and they're just riffing on that. And they're just like, duh. And that's why I think it's important that regardless of what movies are on this list, you have to see these things. You have to sit and you have to watch a movie like Rocky, because otherwise you don't understand why the boxing movie is as popular and as important as it is. Or any sports movie or any romance movie or really any movie on this list, why it's important in our culture, because we reflect on that, you know, and again, it's from our mirror from, so Rodrigo comes at it from a different perspective than Zach, who comes at it from a different perspective than my wife. But I mean, if you're watching The Simpsons and you're just laughing and you don't get the joke, then you're missing out. And that's kind of what it boils down to. You don't get these jokes in The Simpsons. And I had to go through, literally in Homer in Space, we turned a 28-minute show into a two-hour discussion where I was basically like, here's Planet of the Apes. Planet of the Apes was this. Here's a scene from the original Planet of the Apes that Homer is mocking. Here is the scene from 2001. And we just did that through the entire, and this is like 1994.
Right.
95, yeah. Somewhere around there.
Right. So many more space movies to spoof since then.
Yes, we have
so many more
look.
Simpsons episodes.
I was trying to see.
I think that's also the strength of this movie is that it doesn't try to surprise us with plot points.
No, it doesn't.
No.
This movie is, you know, we've talked about that ending being kind of a subversion, but this really is that underdog comes through and he wins the love of the girl. Now, this is important. He doesn't win the girl. That's the thing. She is not his reward.
No,
she chooses him after her brother destroys the house with a baseball bat. She chooses to say, do you want a roommate to him?
Mm-hmm.
That to me, that's amazing.
Which again, another great example of how obviously this movie can't follow the formula because it's writing it as it goes.
Right.
But
it's creating that formula.
In other movies, at the end you get the girl. In this one, the girl gets him halfway through, and then they're a team. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no getting the girl.
Mm-hmm. JR writes in and he says Rocky Balboa is at heart a very good, inarticulate, uneducated club boxer whose side job is muscle for the local mobster. He trains at a local gym where a local trainer sees in Rocky a man who wasted his talent as a potential boxer. When I think of this movie and what it eventually became, I think of Hollywood Shuffle's There's a Bat in the House, where the star asks, how do you know if you have a good movie script? Answer, sequels. Does your character die? If not, you have a good script. And basically for him, this movie is about redemption, given the opportunity.
Yeah.
And that's what Rocky does.
Yeah. Let's give a shout out to our associate producers for this episode of Zach on Film. They are Andrew Hayes, Daniel Cotter, James Rashall, Melanie Nazelrod, Christopher Chrissy, JamesB.com, David Reeves, Dazzler Coaching, Damian Allmark, Brian Fenouf, Andrew Lewis, William Miller, Roger Gudmundsson, Tris Taylor, and Michelle Rettner. Thank you one and all for supporting Zach on Film and Major Spoilers at Large, so we can put out more content for you each and every week.
So story aside, theme aside, there's another big important thing that came out of this movie.
Absolutely.
Go for it, Zach.
So right before Rocky was shot, a man named Garrett Brown started doing some experimenting with camera shots. He had his own production company in Philadelphia. He really loved tracking shots on his dolly, but he only had a couple feet of pipe, so he could go get horizontal for 10 feet, could turn left, and then go more 10 feet, and that was all he could do. So he wanted to get a more free-flowing shot throughout his film. So he started doing some inventing and eventually came up with the Steadicam. And he did some test reels of it, took it out and shopped it around Hollywood. And they got bought up by the first studio he showed it to, shot one movie, which I forget what it's called, and then he shot Rocky because the director saw him running up the museum steps as he chased his girlfriend in his little sizzle reel with a Steadicam. And they ran up the steps and ran back down. And he saw this and he's like, how'd you do it? And where are those steps? Because I need this in my movie. And so then he had a Steadicam rig and then they incorporated it throughout Rocky. It's everywhere in this movie. And it's one of the first ones that did end up winning Oscar for cinematography on this film, all because of him. If you start doing some Googling on YouTube, if you just type in like Garrett Brown Steadicam, it'll come up with a clip, and it's a part of the Rocky 30th anniversary collector DVD or something. And you can see footage of him running around in a field with this old Steadicam, his first one. He got his weird little like Google Glass thing over his eye. He had a fiber optic cable run from the camera up to this like weird headset, so we could see where he was running, see what his shot was, and then just follow wherever. And I mean, he talks about certain shots, like going through the meat locker, mm-hmm. weaving in between the meats, the ice rink, following through the ice rink, through the city as Rocky's running, that mm-hmm. shot when he's running through all the things and the guy throws him an apple, which mm-hmm. was totally random. So all across the town, he just talks about how we got to shoot there. And then he ended up shooting, he worked with Kubrick on
The Shining.
The Shining, in that 3-minute long shot of the kid running his trike. I still haven't watched the movie, but I have it. But I watched that shot and it was amazing.
The Shining. Simpsons reference. Yeah, so Steadicam. That was probably the main thing that I wanted to get out of in this movie was here is a whole new film technique that today people are still trying to find new ways of doing a moving shot without laying pipe to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've got probably 3 different Steadicams in this house. That I've had.
Can you find them?
I can find 2 of them right now because they're in a pile out there in the other room.
Can I have
the other one?
One?
No, you may not, Zach.
Darn it.
The other one is one that I built, is basically a variation. Sam Raimi did a variation of this where he slapped a camera on a 2x4 for Evil Dead. You know, the shots where the camera's moving along the ground and it's zipping up over cars and mm-hmm. and around things. They just basically put the camera on ends of a 2x4. And 2 guys picked up each end and they just ran with it and got that shot of the very smooth flowing shot. And I've got one similar to that where I have basically a 1x4 with 2 handles on the end, about mm-hmm. a 2.5-foot piece with the camera in the middle. And the reason why it's so smooth is the wider that base gets, the steadier the shot or the smoother mm-hmm. the shot becomes. Which is kind of the opposite of what you're told when you're shooting, is hold your arms in tight to your body to keep everything steady. So, but yeah, I built a little one of those, and I've got a whole book on rigs. And people have been trying to do this ever since Rocky, mm-hmm. saying, how can we make this a super smooth shot? I'm about to print out a little stabilizer for my GoPro.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that'll let you do that exact same thing. Mm-hmm. For people who are members, Major Spoilers VIP members at members.majorspoilers.com, I actually have a little behind-the-scenes video of our Critical Hit podcast setup, and I'm simply holding a GoPro out at arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
And walking through the house and showing people this stuff. And I showed it to a bunch of people and they were just like, wow, that's a smooth shot. It's just like, that's what essentially a Steadicam does.
Yeah. And we've kind of seen Steadicam shots evolve now, especially with how cameras are getting so compact and where they're attaching things to like a camera. I mean, there's a shot in Kevin Smith's Red State where one of the characters is running through a field with a gun, mm-hmm. and the camera's attached to the gun, and it's pointed mm-hmm. back to him, and he's kind of in frame, and everything else has been around him, which we've seen just freaking all over the place in the last 5 years
of
film.
And another variation of that is in the movie Pi, where they take that camera and they attach it to the frame of the person, and they turn that camera around so that the person stays in frame, but the whole world is spinning out of control around them. Nominated for, I think, 11 Academy Awards: Best Actor, Best Director, or Best Picture, Best Actress, Best Original Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actor in Burgess Meredith, Best Supporting Actor in Burt Young, who played Polly, Best Film Editing, Best Music, and Best Sound Mixing. 1-3, Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Film Editing. So, that had to be quite a year for a young Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah.
Imagine being basically a nobody who played a thug on a bus in Bananas, holding up Woody Allen, or a Subway, and then turning around and being nominated for Best Actor for Rocky.
And to a large degree, that's why, you know, we see him do just movies that are complete duds.
Yeah, yeah.
Just movies that are just not good at all. He's in them. And
which
and
is
stuff.
So weird.
And then, but it doesn't matter. Like, Rocky, like, shot him so hard into the stratosphere that he can do 1,000 duds, and he's still going to be rich, mm-hmm. and B, he's still going to be fine, mm-hmm. and people will still go see his movies. He's had plenty of good movies.
Well, he has, but it's just amazing that people forget that Sylvester Stallone wrote this movie.
Yeah. That's the craziest thing.
He did.
And I think it's also a tribute to his acting, because you look at Rocky and you instantly think, oh, Sylvester Stallone is this big, dumb East Coast brute,
quote unquote. That's why they cast him,
right? Right,
but no,
right. But yeah, he's like smart. Yeah.
Well, like probably my favorite shot in this movie is when he's like in the back of the car and he pulls out those like giant terrible glasses and like puts them on. He's like, writing down notes. Yeah. I was like, oh, granny glasses. God, this. Why don't I remember any of the good parts of this movie?
Well, that's like the greatest character bit in this film. Was like, Rocky is so serious about trying to do what this mob guy wants and breaking so legs. Like, he needs to get the name spelling right for some reason. Like, he's going to like spell the guy's name to make sure that's who he is.
He wants,
he's just being thorough.
To be taken seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
With the weirdest glasses ever.
I still love the moment where he comes home and he's all beat up and he's talking to his turtles and he's like, if you guys could sing and dance, I wouldn't have to do this crap.
Yeah.
You know, that's such a telling moment. And it's a really subtle chunk of acting from a character that you don't from an actor that we don't think of as being a really subtle guy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you say subtle underplayed moments, you don't immediately think Sylvester Stallone.
There's a lot. And there's
this movie's
a lot
full of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of subtlety in Rocky. Sometimes things are too subtle. I think, again, for example, we were supposed to be able to tell that Adrian was into Rocky.
Sure.
Right.
And we couldn't up until afterwards. And then we're like, oh, thank God.
I mean, up until that point, did you think she maybe had some mental problems?
No, I didn't, because the way that she she was just shy. And then like the way that she communicated with them, I was like, oh, OK, OK. So she's just like, she's just really standoffish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also the way the way she talks to Polly and the way that her boss talks to her,
mm-hmm.
it made me realize, like, it cleared away any issues that I had that, well, like, yeah, maybe she just has like a mental problem of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
There's a super flirty, subtle, but super flirty undertone to their first scene together where he comes into the pet shop and is asking
for two jokes a day, one in the morning, one in the night. You never love my jokes.
The point where he goes over to visit the dog and she looks down at him with that face and you're just like, oh, yeah, she's into him. She doesn't necessarily know it for sure, but she's into him from the first point we see her in this film.
So a little bit of history. You're talking about where this who makes up the list. The American Film Institute was founded in 1965 by a presidential mandate by Lyndon B. Johnson to establish a national arts organization to preserve the legacy of American film heritage, educate the next generation of filmmakers, and honor the artists for their work. 2 years later, in 1967, AFI was established, supported by the National Endowment of the Arts, the Motion Picture Association of America, and the Ford Foundation. The original 22-member board of trustees included Chair Gregory Peck, Vice Chair Sidney Poitier, as well as Francis Ford Coppola, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Jack Valente, and other representatives from the arts and academia. The Institute established a training program for filmmakers known as the Center for Advanced Film Studies. Also created in the early years were a repertory film exhibition program at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and the AFA Catalog of Feature Films, which is where we draw these movies from. The Institute moved to its current 8-acre Hollywood campus in 1981. Film training program grew into the AFI Conservatory, an accredited graduate school. AFI moved its presentation of first-run auteur films from the Kennedy Center to the historic 1938 Art Deco AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center, which now hosts two major film festivals, AFI Fest and AFI Docs, making AFI the largest nonprofit film exhibitor in the world.
Hmm.
So there you go. So that's the history. You can find that on Wikipedia. That's where I read that from. You can also learn about the AFI Conservatory and some of the alumni that come out of that, and the AFI 100 film series and the national list of historical preservation of films. So I don't know if that helped, if that clears anything up for you, but I mean, you look at that list, most of them are white guys. All of them are male. They're the ones that I read off. Although if you look at some of the people that have come out of the conservatory, You see things like Heidi Leavitt, who did The Artist, David Lynch, Terrence Malick, Wally Pfister.
Sure. Yeah, and a bunch of other people. And always the farther back in time you go,
yeah.
the more white dudes you're going to see, almost certainly.
Right.
And the more men specifically, mm-hmm. and the more white people specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
But I mean, I was surprised to hear the name Sidney Poitier. So, mm-hmm. you know.
Sidney Poitier, like a big deal. Next to Bill Cosby, he's probably the biggest deal in entertainment. One could argue Sammy Davis Jr. too. Those would probably be your three biggest of the 60s.
In the 60s, mm-hmm. yeah.
Richard Pryor, maybe a little bit after that, but I mean, as far as people that earned in command of respect.
Pryor's more of a mid-70s.
Yeah. So.
Well, and definitely a different culture as far as that.
Very true.
Sidney Poitier and Richard Pryor, definite mm-hmm. different differences.
Actually, no, they're best friends. They grew up together.
I'm sure they did. And
Buffalo, New York.
Sidney Poitier did some really good stuff that I thought was funny with Bill Cosby and the Uptown Saturday Night and that kind of stuff. I thought were great.
Yeah.
Anything else we need to go over in this movie?
What'd
you learn, Zach?
Well, I mean, just looking back, it's interesting that I don't think anyone would think this is a really low budget film until you kind of understand what low budget, there's one scene that's it's not a digitally restored movie at all. And,
there's some bad looping going on in some of those spots. Yeah.
And there's a scene when he's pulling that girl out from the back of guys, and they're walking through the parking lot. If you listen, you can hear the whirl of the camera go shooting the film. It's so this is low budget enough. They probably might have heard that. We don't care. Most people aren't going to notice it. If they do, it doesn't matter. It's a street.
Nobody's going to know exactly where it is.
When you think about all the moving shots in that, you really have to stop and think about all the moving shots in that. It's all mm-hmm. done with Steadicam. And they probably saved a crap ton of money because if they were trying to do those shots with grips, they wouldn't have been able to do it. It would take them hours upon hours to set up that track.
This is your 1960s kung fu movie to a certain degree. Just zoom, zoom.
There was only one zoom.
Have you ever seen? You guys have seen Blow Up?
Yeah.
Blow Up is literally is just zooms on purpose. Zoom, 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 zoom. Because guess what just got invented, guys?
The
zoom lens. So there's a lot of moving shots when you have the guy who invented the Steadicam. The thing is though is nowadays we're so used to moving shots that they're not that. First off, it's not as off-putting as the zoom, period, because we're used to looking at things while moving.
Right.
And second, it's something that has really taken hold and hasn't really gone out of fashion the way that the zoom has.
Sure.
From the opening scenes, this is one thing I wanted to say even over on the Major Spoilers podcast. From the opening scenes, they're getting ready to do a Daredevil TV series on Netflix, an original series from Marvel mm-hmm. Studios. And I want it set in 1975, and I want it to look dirty and gritty streets of Philadelphia look here, but even 10 times worse. Mm-hmm. I mean, this takes place in Philadelphia, but those are some dirty, gross streets.
Yeah.
And that's what I want to see. I want it to take place in the 70s. I want it to be dirty and gross like what we saw in Rocky. And if they did that, my mind would be blown.
That'd be amazing.
Mixed taxi driver with
the stores and the houses are dirty.
Yeah.
Paulie's apartment, I needed to take a shower after
watching.
But it's
a house, though. That's the thing. It's not like an apartment. It's like a house. He's got a lawn and a fake lawn with fake flowers. And do you ever also notice how they downplayed all the holidays in this? It's like Thanksgiving. Yeah. It's like, let's go out.
Yeah. Well,
it's Christmas. Yeah. Christmas passes. And hey, you want a roommate?
Well, Rocky even says that. And she's like, it's Thanksgiving. He's like, it's Thursday to me.
Yeah.
So let's go.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's kind of like that formula hasn't taken root yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are sectors of the population that don't really care about Christmas, for example, as much as they care about Easter.
Right.
You know, or they just don't care about either of those things at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we rarely ever see those because there's so many family comedies that take place over Christmas.
Right.
There's so many movies where bad things are happening and it's Christmas, you know, does Die Hard?
Die Hard
takes place over Christmas. Yeah. You know, you just get that all the
Home
time.
Yeah, why is Die Hard it's my favorite Christmas movie when they really mention Christmas? You get three holidays. This flight takes place on New Year's Eve.
Mm-hmm.
You have
New Year's Day.
New Year's Day.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas and then Thanksgiving.
Yep.
Yeah.
And like, but no one really associates this movie with because it's those things.
They don't even play it up.
I mean, Apollo Express is like either, Fourth of July.
Well, yeah, because he's coming there for the Christmas party. The thing's taking place at a Christmas party. He's coming there for the Christmas holiday.
I mean, I guess. But then people die, and that's way better than that.
They
part.
Say Christmas.
They say yeah, Christmas. They say Christmas.
Yeah, which in Rocky, they're just like, oh, is it Thanksgiving? Okay, cool.
Yeah, well, I mean, they,
but I think that also,
they don't even play up the 5 weeks that he has to train.
Yeah, no.
Right, but that also plays into the thing where Rocky is just this guy who goes and he grinds and he has to beat people up for a living. And he wants, you know, he thought he could be a big fighter, but then he goes and he fights and he gets $40 for the night. You know, yeah. It really plays into that. He's just grinding through his life when this thing shows up and he has his, you know, his moment that we know is going to launch him into 5 sequels. But for all he knows is a 3-round knockout. It kind of works to the film's advantage. Because it you know, it paints him as a guy who just has his head down all the time. He doesn't pay attention to things like that. To me, it's Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of good stuff. And this is one of those movies where, like, oh, kind of going into it, I was like, oh, Rocky, underdog story. Right. But that's like the least amount of thing you can take away from this at all. There's so much more, even that we've discovered in
War?
My minds before this.
Did you see Worf in this?
I don't know.
Fisherman's Worf, yeah. That was the scene where he went to go beat up that guy for breaking his thumbs.
Michael Dorn as Worf.
Oh, yeah?
Michael Dorn was one of Apollo's retinue.
Mm.
Yeah, for like 5 seconds.
$40 in 1975.
And I'm like, hey, that's Worf.
$40 in 1975 would be $179.61 today.
Mm. There you go.
So he fought that for less than $180.
Yeah, which is...
How much would $5 be?
How much? Because
that's how much he had to pay to use the shower.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That would be $22.
Yipe.
You had to pay $22 to take a shower.
Well, I think that's his gym membership, isn't it? Or
after the fight when he's rattling off, you know, the shower fee.
No. That's clearly that guy being a shyster.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 7% tax.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Zach, take us out of here.
All right, that's going to do it for this week on Zach on Film. Make sure to go to majorspoilers.com to give all of your thoughts about Rocky in this episode and the podcast posting page. And while you're there, make sure to click on that Amazon.com link where you can go buy all of your Rocky memorabilia, all 17 Rocky movies, all on glorious Blu-ray. It won't cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to Major Spoilers to keep this ship afloat. So that's it for this week. Next week, we will be talking about Casablanca. You look at my notes. Casablanca. Yep, we're going to go with that next week on Zach on Film.